The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good morning. If we could all take our seats and let's get going, please. But first, could I see a show of hands of anyone who has a cell phone with them? Great. Now, while your hand is up, can you take that cell phone and turn it to quiet? Thank you. Welcome, and thank you all for joining us here today at American University's Washington College of Law for what promises to be a most interesting morning. Promoting a pro bono and philanthropic culture in Mexico is this morning's topic. There's such a robust set of programming here at the law school. I want to make sure you're on the right flight here. I'm Betsy Cavendish, Executive Director of Appleseed, which is a network of public interest justice centers in the U.S. and Mexico. And we work by leveraging the talents of the pro bono bar and other professionals to achieve systematic structural changes that protect vulnerable people, promote access to justice, and expand opportunity for all. Appleseed is pleased to sponsor this morning's event with the Washington College of Law and the Embassy of Mexico, and we invite you all to a reception this evening at the Mexican Cultural Center at 2829 16th Street Northwest, also sponsored by the Embassy of Mexico, Coca-Cola, and the Rabin Group. This morning's events are free, thanks to the Washington College of Law, but there's a small charge for this evening's festivities. So we read in the paper about financial meltdowns, traditional wars around the world that never seem to end, escalating drug wars on the U.S.-Mexico border, and so many problems, but today's discussion should be much more hopeful. Our panelists today, without sugarcoating the difficulties Mexicans face, should give us each a sense that we can be change agents, that we can act now or later to tackle problems at their root and make life better for many, many people. They will give us a sense that each of us can be a force for democracy, justice, or opportunity, whether we are primarily attorneys in private practice, whether we are Americans or Mexicans, whether we serve on a nonprofit board or make nonprofit work our careers. Let me preview the morning. Our first panel, moderated by Appleseed board members Eric Koenig and Bob Herstein, will provide an overview of pro bono in the U.S., in Latin America, and in Mexico. Joining Eric and Bob will be Professor and former Dean Elliot Milstein of the Washington College of Law, Macarena Saiz, the International Programs Coordinator of the Washington College of Law, and Antonio Stolper, a partner at Sherman & Sterling, representing the Cyrus Vance Center. The second panel, which I will moderate, will provide a more granular, concrete view of the main themes of the conference. We will have an on-the-ground view of some of the main ways Appleseed and our partners are working to develop civil society and a robust non-governmental organization sector, promote the rule of law, and develop a pro bono philanthropic culture. I'm honored to be on that panel with Maru Cortazar, the Executive Director of Mexico Appleseed, Lisa Dewey, who's sitting next to her, the pro bono partner at DLA and a leader of its New Perimeter project, Scott Reckler of Ashoka, the leading organization promoting social entrepreneurship and a great partner of Mexico Appleseed, and Alexis Rovzar, who just joined us in back, of the Latin American Practice Group at White & Case, and a member of the board of both National Appleseed and Mexico Appleseed. As moderators, Eric, Bob, and I will give a bit more biographical information in a few minutes about our panelists. But before we delve in, a few more thanks and administrative matters. Eric Gutierrez, Appleseed's Immigrant Programs Director, in the back with the glasses, was instrumental in organizing this event over the past several months. It was a major coordinating effort, and we're very grateful to him. Jennifer Dabson of the Washington College of Law leads a fantastic team and hosts a stunning number of intellectually interesting events here, and without her and her team, this wouldn't be possible. Dean Claudio Grossman, who couldn't be with us today, is an inspiration to us all. He welcomed us warmly when we proposed this idea, as it dovetails so well with his distinguished career linking law students and the profession to the growth of democracy and human rights around the world, and especially in Latin America. Carlos Ortiz, the board chair of Mexico Appleseed, also couldn't be with us due to his conflicting board meetings with his company in Mexico, but he's been a dedicated leader who's played a leading role in building Mexico Appleseed and helping to provide and strengthen the foundation for civil society in Mexico. I want to thank Jose Borjon of the Embassy of Mexico here. Thank you. Again, a sponsor of tonight's event, and he's helped coordinate the presence of the ambassador who will grace us this evening. And he's been just a terrific partner in this and a project, the embassy has been a project partner too of Mexico Appleseed. We have a few other Appleseed board members here today too. Bob Loeffler, Phil Zeidman, Ralph Petersberger, and the three I mentioned earlier from panels. So that said, we'll have two panels with opening remarks from each panelist and questions from the moderator. After the first panel, we'll have a brief Q&A session, unlike what's written on your programs. And we'll have a second Q&A session after the second panel. And we'll have lunch together, generously hosted by the Washington College of Law. CLE credit is available, and the proceedings will be filmed and podcast, and we hope that today's proceedings will be useful, especially in Mexico, at a later date. Again, thank you all for joining us. Eric?
I think this works. Good morning, everybody, and welcome. Thank you for coming today. Appleseed, as you know, is an organization that promotes systemic reform and systemic change, tries to make sure the system works better and more fairly and serves the interests of justice. When we began thinking about opening a chapter in Mexico, we discovered, as people in Mexico know already, that Mexico has a flourishing civil society, thousands of organizations that are working every day to try to improve the lives of ordinary citizens. So the question for Appleseed was, where could we add value within this network in Mexico? How could we partner with organizations? Where could we make a difference? And it was really by focusing on systemic reform, by trying to change the culture of the Mexican legal bar, that we thought we could really make an impact. Bob Hirstein, my co-panel host, is really the visionary in this effort. He has had a long and distinguished career of work with Mexican companies and with the Mexican government, represented Mexico's interests in NAFTA's negotiations. And I think Bob seized on a vision that was possible as Mexico emerged from one-party rule in the last decade with the orderly transition of power, where there was an opportunity for an organization like Appleseed to argue for systemic and political and policy reform on the merits without an association with any particular political party or advanced blessing from any party. Quite a sort of revolutionary change in the way policy changes worked in Mexico. And Bob cultivated a really top-notch group of Mexican attorneys from private companies, from law firms, and from the pro bono bar to come together and in 2002 begin the formation of what is now part of our network as Mexico Appleseed. And so it's really been a privilege for me to work with Bob and also all of my Mexican colleagues and the staff over the years here in Washington and our field staff in Texas that Betsy mentioned that have been very actively involved in getting the organization up and running. I guess the toughest early decision for Mexico Appleseed was what to call itself, since Appleseed was not a concept that was really known, a story that was really known widely in Mexico. And the board of Mexico Appleseed, before they settled on the name of the organization, was trying to come up with some kind of equivalent that would be maize or corn, but ultimately decided the best thing to do for consistency's sake was to go with Appleseed Mexico, and so the name has stuck. Our panel, I'm really privileged to have three really distinguished people on our panel today. I hope we'll have a lively discussion. I'm going to start first with a short presentation. I know you all have the slide deck. Let me see if I can get this to come up. It is there, but it's not on my screen. I will prepared for this. It's it's not on the screen in front of me, but that's okay. You all have a copy of this, so I won't go over all of these points in a very short 5 or 6 minute overview. Okay, great. Thank you very much. Now, the question is, which button do you press to go forward? Sorry. This one, okay, this one, and great. But it's not doing its thing.
That Microsoft background.
Yeah, it's,
okay, now
can we go to full screen on this? I'm sorry.
There you go, you got it. Okay.
Which phone has been marked? Thank you very much.
Yeah, is that the right slide?
We're going to go back to one. Oh, there we go. Great. This is a quick historical perspective on pro bono and pro bono trends. I don't think we can do justice to any of this in just a couple of minutes, but I think it's fairly well perceived in the U.S. that Justice Louis Brandeis, in his practicing career as an attorney, Louis Brandeis is one of sort of the founding fathers of pro bono work in the United States with the Brandeis Brief. And his belief that lawyers should give back to the community to represent the poor and the disadvantaged, to work for justice, to make the system work better. There's long been a tradition here in Washington, D.C. in particular, of lawyers leaving their law firms and their regular practice and going into and seizing opportunities to give public service and working in the government for periods of time and then coming back and resuming their legal careers. And it's fair to say that from the 50s and probably substantially earlier than that, to the 70s, various social movements, including the long struggle against racial segregation, the work of the NAACP and other organizations, sort of laid the groundwork for a broader interest in the legal community to do pro bono work. There were a number of changes as well that were brought on by John F. Kennedy's New Frontier and President Johnson's Great Society programs that really captured the imagination of lawyers and what they could really do to help make society better, fairer, more just, and to work on those causes. So all of the things that happened in the 60s really helped build the foundation that grew, and then with Watergate and the disenchantment that came from that and the desire to make the political system work better, more fairly, more honestly, more transparently, we saw a substantial increase, at least in the United States, of pro bono work in law firms and law schools and interest and demand from students during that period. This one? There we go. So law students have actually been one of the principal catalysts for change, and also the American Bar Association, I think, reacting to some of these social trends and demands from its own membership, increased its own support for pro bono as an organization. The ABA has a model rule of professional conduct, it's Rule 6.1, which encourages pro bono work, at least 50 hours of work per year of pro bono, in representing the poor organizations which serve the poor without expectation of remuneration. There's a website that has very extensive materials on it. Many of you are probably familiar with that. But the ABA has helped regularize this sort of sense and desire among lawyers to do work in this area and to promote it more widely. A number of other catalysts have come together to increase the amount of pro bono work that is being done by lawyers in the country. One is publicity. I think you can't underestimate the value of an organization or a magazine like The American Lawyer, which annually lists firms in accordance with and ranks them with consideration of the kind of commitment that they make to pro bono, how many hours are devoted, whether associates or partners are rewarded for the work. When The American Lawyer started ranking firms, it didn't include pro bono, but several years ago decided to, and since then it has become a major driving force among firms to do better in this area. a number of organizations, the Pro Bono Institute being one of them, launched a law firm challenge to get firms to more systemically adopt pro bono guidelines to encourage perhaps 3 or even 5% minimum thresholds among their lawyers per year. More than 150 firms have joined that effort. Now there is a corporate pro bono effort which has garnered support from more than 70 firms to do something similar to get corporate legal departments to make the same kinds of commitments that law firms have increasingly made. And law schools themselves have devoted more resources to pro bono. Part of that, and Elliot will probably be able to speak to that best, has been through the engine of clinical legal education, opportunities that law students now have to practice and gain practical experience during their education and to open their eyes to opportunities for practice as a career. Law schools have consistently in the last 20 years found ways to give public service and public interest a higher priority. They see it actually, in addition to its being a good in itself, as a way to market themselves among, to try to attract the best and the brightest students, and as a key indicator of the success and health of the law school. American University has been a leader, and the Washington College of Law has been a leader in that area. Public interest law centers, many of which are affiliated with and sponsored by law schools, maybe some of them are semi-independent, work on systemic policy reform work. The Brennan Center at New York University is an example of that. And the National Association of Law Placement now includes a directory of legal employers, within its directory of legal employers, public interest law opportunities as well. So there has been an increasing and broad array of opportunities available. And within the Americas, there's a new initiative. Alexis might have an opportunity to talk a little bit about that or others on our panel that took about 7 years to fruition, in which seven countries joined together, the bar, law firms and bar associations, members of the judiciary, not-for-profit organizations, governmental entities, quite broadly to try to do something similar to what the American Bar Association had done in trying to encourage pro bono work, but to do it in the cultural context that made sense for their societies. You could see that their pro bono is defined as actions carried out for the public good and also legal services without a fee or an expectation for a fee. And also the declaration sets a minimum standard of 20 hours per lawyer per year, a sort of a worthy starting goal to try to encourage really a cultural change in the way lawyers view their commitment to the society in which they work. There are many other international efforts. The American Bar Association has a rule of law initiative. Over the last 2 years, it has combined many regional efforts under a single umbrella to promote access to justice and human rights. The Public Interest Law Institute has sponsored a European conference. And there's an interesting project that has a substantial representation here in Washington where senior or retired lawyers participate in the International Senior Lawyers Project, in which they volunteer and are lent out to around the world to organizations and projects that can benefit from their expertise and guidance for periods of time. I won't spend a lot of time talking about the various projects, but they are very broadly represented around the world. There are projects as well in Latin America. Appleseed was founded in 1993, as I mentioned, as a systemic reform organization. We have 16 public interest justice centers located around the country and in Mexico City, our first international center. We have a national office and field staff that are designed to support our centers and promote and in their coordination, raise funds, provide expertise and guidance, and an executive director council to promote coordination and best practices between and among the various organizations that we have. And we've also encouraged law firms which support us. Appleseed has received millions of dollars each year in in-kind pro bono support from law firms. And we've encouraged law firms to step up as they've designed signature projects to support us more broadly and in several of our jurisdictions. Latham & Watkins has done an extensive Appleseed election reform project. It went dead on me again. My usual tricks are not. To build, I'll just use the... the signature projects, and also we are indebted to DLA Piper, and Lisa Dewey is here, for her support and for their organization support for our Mexico Appleseed Center and the partnership that they have with Mexico Appleseed that is just getting underway now, that she may be able to tell you more about during the next panel as well. Appleseed Mexico, as I mentioned, started in 2002. One of their signature projects has been Project RED, or Pro Bono Mexico, which is to establish a clearinghouse for pro bono projects that would really start the process of changing the way law firms and lawyers thought about the way they could give, to encourage them to give service back to the community, and to encourage them to think about the importance of using their talents to improve their society. Project RED works in three principal areas: the protection of children involved in deportations from the U.S., and broadly in financial education matters, and in the right of identity. There's these projects are explained in great deal on our website, Mexico Appleseed website, the citation for which is at the bottom of the slide in your notes. The clearinghouse is designed to take projects and needs at this point from organizations and to find matches in the private bar and with individuals who can provide support and expertise. I think there are great goals for expanding this program over time, but it's been launched and is substantially off the ground. And it's also designed to really build bridges and to build expertise in the private bar to service these areas more broadly and to foster relationships among nonprofit groups and the private bar. It's a really sort of break down some of the walls and divisions that have always characterized legal practice in Mexico City and other places around the country. There are also aspirations of Appleseed to grow its program geographically within Mexico, both through the growth of the board and through the reach of its projects. I'm going to stop here and introduce our panelists, each of whom are going to talk for about 5 minutes, and then we're going to have some questions, I think, and discussion among the group, and then we'll invite questions from the audience. The first is Elliot Milstein, who I think many of you here already know very well. We're delighted to have him. He's a former dean of the Washington College of Law and the interim president of American University. And is currently a professor at the Washington College of Law and has really been a pioneer in the development of clinical education in the United States going back now for almost 40 years, really at the infancy of, he was really there at the creation. We're glad to have him. So, Elliot, let me turn the microphone over to you.
Thank you. Do we want to speak from the table? Or? Well, I have to say that a lot of what you gave in your prepared remarks are in my prepared remarks, which I will now tear up, about the grand tradition of the legal profession in the United States. I guess when Eric Gutierrez called me to speak, he asked if I would speak about a comparison between the United States and Mexico, and I said, well, I've only been to Mexico once, so I'm perhaps not the greatest person to speak about it. But I tried to find out. I called many colleagues to see, and I did, and you know, in reflecting on the time that I was there, when I went there to learn about and talk about clinical education, the legal culture there is quite different from ours in the sense that the law schools are run very differently. Most faculty aren't really what we would consider full-time faculty. Here in the United States, we have the most luxurious legal education system in the world. Our faculty are paid handsomely teach and to write and to think about the legal profession, law, the legal system. And so we have this cadre of people who are detached from allegiance to particular clients, detached from having to do the things that lawyers do to make a living, and to be able to think at a loftier level about how the legal system might be better and how legal pedagogy might be better. And we're unconstrained by the need to make a living on the outside, which afflicts many people, many academics in Mexico and actually all through the Americas, if not much of the world. I'm doing work in China these days and helping develop clinical education in China. And the same is true there, that many of the law professors there also have to engage in the practice of law in order to make a complete living. I was actually, last time I went to China, in China you always bring a gift, and I'm seeing there's some nice gifts at the table here, and last time I brought beautifully gift-wrapped gifts from the law school, and as my recipients opened the gifts, it said exactly what it says on this, which is made in China. I hoped there would be something from Mexico, but... Claudio Grossman, our dean, isn't here today because he's in the Dominican Republic, where he is called to court on a case that he's handling pro bono. This evening, competing with your event at the Mexican Cultural Institute, here we have our annual Peter Chiquino dinner, named after a beloved departed faculty member. Where we are giving awards to our three alumni, one international, two domestic, who are exemplars of public interest representation, of people who do the kind of work that you're trying to inspire. And we give awards to our students tonight for the pro bono work that they've done during the time in law school. So this idea of a culture of pro bono is embedded in the fabric of the law school in ways that we barely think about anymore. The law school gives bragging rights to, awards bragging rights to people who do pro bono work with the intention of inspiring our students to continue to do it over a lifetime of being a lawyer. I don't think we should be too smug about the amount of free legal services that's provided by the legal profession. There was, when Rule 6.1, it calls for lawyers to give 50 hours a year. Originally, that was intended to be mandatory, but it's aspirational, and it's not clear that what percentage of people actually comply. There's tremendous need for legal services, and the pro bono work of lawyers matters a lot, but there's still a lot of unmet need. So what we're trying to do in our law school, sort of moving on a multitude of fronts, but I'll talk a bit about the role of clinical legal education. In clinical legal education, we assign our students to real cases, real clients, and give them responsibility for handling those cases. The way I like to talk about it these days is that we put students into the first moment of adulthood. We make them responsible for another person in professional role. And at that moment, they are opened up to learning in ways that don't reoccur in life. And so we as clinical teachers sit on their shoulder and whisper in their ears to help them understand the thing that they're seeing. And what they're seeing is the reality of what law means in the lives of people, and in our case, in the lives of poor people. And they get to see what advantage the represented have in a legal system where many people are unrepresented. They get to see the way law operates in these people's lives. So. In our clinics, we represent only poor people, and we focus on not being cause lawyers per se, but rather individual client cases. We think that students will see the world more clearly in that way, and that representing individual clients really constitute the building block for developing professional values. Now, that when you think about the importance of having, let me just take a step back. Who should inculcate skills and values in young lawyers? It happens serendipitously in most societies. That is, every lawyer has a first day of practice. Every lawyer has a first year of practice. We think that when that happens on the street, you learn from other lawyers the scrappy ways that lawyers can make a living, or at least that's possible. You can learn the worst practice. You can learn survival practice. But if the people who are the transmitters are people who have a critical distance from practice, the probability of teaching at an aspirational level is increased. And so I think one of the major differences in the United for the United States is the fact that clinical education is provided by full-time faculty. And I think that a great change in Mexico would be to have clinical programs where these values are transmitted by faculty. I think I've abused my time, but that's at least one thought for the day.
Thank you, Elliot. Our second panelist who will open with some remarks is Macarena Saez. Pronounced that right?
Yes.
Great. And she is the International Programs Coordinator at the Washington College of Law, and she's had a substantial teaching experience in Latin America, in Chile and Costa Rica, teaching on jurisprudence and feminist legal theory, on human rights. She also coordinates the Washington College of Law Summer Program in Chile. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I also told Eric that knowledge of Mexico is very limited. Actually, I was in Mexico last week for the book presentation on a case book that we just edited, myself and another colleague, on gender and sexuality in Latin America. And so I had the privilege of having this book presentation at the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court Justice Cosío was also commenting on this book. And he also mentioned something that is pertinent to this, precisely to this panel, and it's the idea that we do all lawyers, we need to do more, and that we need to take cases, and we need to be active in helping those that are disadvantaged as women and sexual minorities. Having said that, what I would like to talk briefly today is about the pro bono culture or non-culture in Latin America, referring specifically about Chile, and why there is no, or it's a very very recent emerging culture on pro bono. And I think that, first of all, there is a structural issue here, because there are no incentives for law firms, for example, to do pro bono work. When in Chile, and I believe that this repeats, the model repeats in many Latin American countries, in order to become a lawyer, there are several steps that require free legal assistance before graduating. So, for example, in Chile, a graduate from any law school in Chile, before getting the professional title of lawyer, which is granted by the Supreme Court in the case of Chile, they need to work for free for the state for 6 months. And that is it's called the Corporación de Asistencia Judicial. So everybody works for free for the state for 6 months. And there is also the institution of the el turno, which is would be, I guess, translated as the legal shift, where every lawyer can be called to take on cases for free for people who don't have money to have his or her own attorney. And this is mandatory. So every once in a while, and of course when in small cities, the turno repeats a lot for the same people. So I will talk about the problems that these sort of incentives or non-incentives have. In addition, every school, most schools have clinical programs that were not intended, and Elliot may correct me here if, or maybe he has a different approach, but were not intended as educational tools per se, but were more of legal assistance, period. So the students were on their own, and they did whatever they could with the cases that they had. And there was this idea that in the process, you would also get educated. But the focus was not on legal education, was more on legal assistance, more than anything else. So, but the question is whether this is just a matter of culture. And what I was mentioning before to some of you was that I don't think that it's only a problem of philanthropy. Is that, can we say really that American lawyers are per se better persons than Latin American lawyers, and they just take cases because they have this incredible sense of helping others? And on the other hand, Latin American lawyers are greedy and mean, and really they don't want to take any cases. I don't think that either is true. And I think that there is a system of incentives in place in the U.S. that it's not non-existent so far in Latin America. And so this system of incentives, and it has to do a lot with the ABA, has also meant that by now a senior partner may, it doesn't matter whether they really, a senior partner really cares about the pro bono of their young associates. There are other incentives for the senior partners to accept and even give the green light for their associates to work on pro bono. So reviewing a little bit what the ABA website says, for example, and both of you mentioned the pertinent rules here, but it's interesting that says, well, the terms pro bono comes from the Latin pro bono publico, which means from the public good, and the website says, the American Bar Association has described the parameters for pro bono for practicing lawyers in the model rules of professional conduct. Nearly every state has an ethical rule that calls upon lawyers to render pro bono services. So the ABA has a lot to do here, and the fact that there are strong ethical controls from the ABA to the lawyers. And you have to bear in mind that in Latin America, the bar associations do not control the profession, neither the legal education. So there you have a disconnection that I think that Appleseed and other organizations as the Pro Bono Foundation in Chile have to serve as a bridge, basically. You don't have those ethical controls that basically are an incentive from the top down to have a pro bono done. The website also keeps on saying, for example, in terms of the law schools and students, it ends up, the last paragraph says, for students, do pro bono work accomplish more than satisfying much-needed legal needs? They also enhance their career development and make themselves more attractive to potential employers. So it's not philanthropy by itself. There are other incentives that need to be in place. And I'm not saying that it is a bad thing that there are other incentives. I don't think that pro bono should be just a matter of philanthropy. There is a need for legal assistance, and so we need to target different ways of getting that legal assistance done or provided. So what happens with the free legal assistance model that we have in Chile? As I mentioned, we have a six-month practical training that it's for free, and you could say that is a lot of lawyers. They are working for free for 6 months. It should be enough. But according to the Corporación de Asistencia Judicial in itself, the body that provides the system for prospective attorneys to become eligible to get the professional title, it says that in 2008, they administered more than 1,700 practicas. I mean, that means that there were at least 1,700 people doing this practical training. And it says that only 6% were approved as outstanding. There were 54 resolutions where the board of the corporación had to sanction an applicant for performing poorly during the practica or infringing the rules that guide the work of the corporación. 71 practicas were terminated due to the resignation of the lawyer or because the lawyer did not provide the legal assistance required by the case. In my own experience, when I did my practical training, I had 116 cases that I had to handle all by myself in 6 months. And what that meant is that most of the cases I just had to print out the same written petition to different courts to say, where is the file? It's missing. Most of the files were missing. So it's a problem that it's not that lawyers do not care, but it's a system that makes lawyers do not care. The problem, I believe, it's not that we have to replace the corporación. I think that it has to be valued in a different way. There is no value on the corporación. When we get there, nobody tells us how important our job is. And at the end, we get most of the attorneys are insensitive to all these people lining up out there who have a claim. But there are petty claims, and nobody wants the petty claims. So that's the other point, I think, that we have to talk a little bit, and the difference between free legal assistance and pro bono. For some reason, pro bono seems more glamorous than free legal assistance. And I think that is something that we need to think about, how we make legal assistance be pro bono work and not have this disconnection between pro bono and legal assistance. Just to finish, the shift system was actually contested by the Chilean Bar Association, and it presented a claim before the International Labor Organization, claiming that the shift system was amounted to forced labor, and they won. So not even the Bar Association wants to do this, and. Again, I think that pro bono is great. I just think that also we need to make it in a way that it has a control not only from the sides but also from the top. So maybe more connections with bar associations, though they don't have ethical controls. So at least in Chile, with Pinochet just took away all the powers of professional associations, not only the lawyers' associations. But no one has ethical control now, unless it's something that really you want to go to court for. But there is a whole middle term things that you are not necessarily worth going to court for, and you don't have anybody that is controlling those situations. Pro bono may come in that situation, in that gray area, that somebody has to say, hey, this is your responsibility. Somebody has to take care of the need. And so there are other incentives also. It's, for example, many, and you talked about the strong civil society system in Mexico that also works in different countries. A group of lawyers in Chile created what it's called the Libertades Públicas. But I never thought, and I'm part of Libertades Públicas, and I take my own pro bono work. I never called it pro bono until this year, I think, when I had to sort of say, well, yeah, that's I do on the side. I don't do it. It's not part of what I do here at the law school. Like, yes, I do take cases at the Inter-American Commission on Freedom of Expression, on Sexual Orientation, and what have you. But it was not either in my head that I was doing pro bono, because I don't need to report to anyone any number of hours that I do that I'm not billing. So I'll finish this just food for thought, I guess.
Thank you very much, Macarena, for your comments. Our third panelist is Antonia Stolper, and she is a partner at Sherman & Sterling. She has a practice in corporate finance and transactions in emerging markets, very relevant with the current economy. And she is also affiliated with the Cyrus Vance Center, which broadly promotes access to justice and democratic development, and has done a lot of work in Latin America, including work on the declaration on pro bono, so I turn the microphone over to her.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here representing the Vance Center, of which I chair the New York City Bar Committee that oversees the Vance Center. And we're also, I want to thank Appleseed, because we have been active collaborators with Appleseed in Mexico. Are very excited about the work that Appleseed's doing in Mexico, and I can tell you a few things about Chile. One of the focuses of the Vance Center, which sort of broadly speaking is the international arm of the New York City Bar Association, and our special niche, I would say, is that we have been able to mobilize the private bar in New York, which is obviously a very powerful private bar, to go out and evangelize on the issue of pro bono throughout Latin America. We also have a very important program going on in South Africa that we're trying to move up into East Africa. And this mobilization of the private bar gives us a piece of leverage, in particular in Latin America, to talk to the private bar in the many countries where we have been active. Through a series of meetings that culminated in a strategy session in New York in 2005, a decision was made to launch a drafting process for the Pro Bono Declaration for the Americas. And we established a drafting committee that was chaired by Todd Kreider in New York, had members of the private bar from Mexico, Colombia, Peru, Chile, Argentina, and Brazil coming together to draft this declaration that Eric put up, some key elements of it. And it wasn't just that their drafting committee came together and they came up with the ultimate manifestation of pro bono. It was much, much more intensive than that. And we mobilized our lawyers in New York to essentially fan out and do a series of very high-level meetings. We did one in Mexico, one in Colombia, Peru, Chile, Argentina, and Brazil. I personally was involved in three of those meetings, where we had discussions both individually and collectively with the private bar, with bar associations, where there are bar associations, which isn't everywhere, with the law schools, and with the NGOs, focusing on, and I think very much in the Appleseed, in the way Appleseed sees it, in what we call the pro bono chain, the critical element of bringing these elements together, which in many countries barely speak to each other. And every country is unique. One of the fascinating things for me, having worked in all of these countries professionally, is getting to know sort of the more political NGO side of things. They are all very, they come out of very different places. To develop a pro bono culture, which is a pro bono culture for our purposes among the private bar. You talked about the need to create incentives, and we very much agree with that. One of the messages that we went out with as part of the whole drafting process was what we called the business case for pro bono. And it's a little like the question of pay to play. You know, there was a fuss a couple of years ago about the law firms essentially being charged by the NGOs to provide cases for to keep people busy on pro bono. And I'm like, well, of course you're going to charge for that service. Why is pay to play a bad thing? And why is a business case for pro bono a bad thing? A business case for pro bono is clearly critically important in convincing our own managements here in the United States that we should take on much more mandatory approaches to pro bono, which many of our law firms have in the United States. And it allowed us, the private bar, to go out to the private bar throughout Latin America and say there is a business case to be made. There's an ethical case to be made, it goes without saying. And there are countries, including Mexico, where there is an ethical obligation in Mexico for private lawyers to provide pro bono services. It's just nobody is meeting that ethical obligation. In the United States, of course, we do. It is in the ethical canons that we have that obligation. There's no mandatory pro bono. It kicked around, Judith Kaye and the Court of Appeals kicked it around for years in New York, never quite got there. Obviously, there's the ABA, which is not mandatory. The ABA, of course, is not a mandatory bar in the United States. A key element to the business case in the United States is the American Lawyer A-List, and I will tell you, as a partner in a prominent firm, the A-List is a very important motivator for all sorts of high-quality behavior. So we very much are focused on the pro bono culture in Latin America. And as part of this rollout, we sort of rolled the pro bono declaration out to the various constituent pieces of what we consider the pro bono chain. And that gave people an opportunity to really start talking to each other. The result was the declaration. It went into effect in January of 2008. There's a 3-year implementation process. We have signatories in all of the countries that I've talked to, and some others like Ecuador who have signed on as well, where we haven't had an opportunity to actually roll it out, although I think they're going to be part of our Colombia program next month, and where we are, where many, many prominent corporate law firms in the region have signed up. I will tell you that I have used my personal leverage to make that happen. Certainly in Mexico, I've called up senior partners of most of the prominent law firms in Mexico and said, I think you need to do this, and I'll remember if you don't. So again, the leverage of the New York City bar here has been really highly influential in twisting arms and getting people to sign up. The next phase, and this is where, of course, Appleseed is so critical, as are other important NGOs, including the Mexico City Bar Association has their own referral system that's obviously very important, is actually getting the law firms to do the pro bono that they have committed to. So with all the top law firms having signed up, the key problem from the law firm side and why the NGOs such as Appleseed are such important links in all of this is how do you get organized? And one of the things we're focused on in the Van Center is helping the law firms get organized and helping the NGOs get organized. The law schools, where that's appropriate, a place like Columbia, where the law schools are a substitute for the bars. The law school alumni associations are in lieu of bar associations, for example, and where they also have mandatory clinical programs, which in Columbia is a year long. You can't graduate without a year clinical program. But the key thing for the law firms now is actually making it happen. So they've put their names on these pieces of paper. They have committed. You can go to our Van Center, to our Van Center website through the New York City Bar, and you will see the signatories. These signatories are public, and now it's making it happen. And that we're relying very much on the NGO community to help, but also we have discovered that the NGOs, as you are, I'm sure we're well aware at Appleseed, need help in how to source the cases. One of the things that is a desperate fear of the private bar throughout the region, I've had these conversations in particular in Mexico, is they're terrified of the line out the door of needy people in need of legal services, and how are they possibly going to deal with them? And we've told everybody throughout the region, you're not going to deal with them. I'm on the pro bono committee at Sherman and Sterling. Let me tell you, we are not screening candidates. We are taking cases from Appleseed. We're taking cases from Pillay. We're taking cases from the Vet Center. We're taking cases from any number of providers, you know, the ACLU, and on and on and on it goes, because I'm a law firm. I'm a corporate law firm. I'm not a street-level legal services clinic. So the key element of helping the NGOs develop referral mechanisms and being able to screen. The other key thing in Mexico, and I hope the next panel can talk about it, is the private law firms are terrified of the cost of litigating in Mexico. In the United States, if you have a lawyer, the access to justice is basically free. You have very low filing costs, you may have transcript costs, et cetera, but it is a manageable and knowable cost, provided you have a high-quality lawyer. A place like Mexico, that is not true. The access to the court system is very, very bad. And so I've had private law firms tell me, we can't do impact litigation, we just can't afford it. much less the political problems that arise from things like impact litigation. So there are a number of issues there that are critically important to kind of getting the law firms from the I've signed my name to a piece of paper committing each lawyer in my law firm to 20 hours per person per year of pro bono services to actually making those numbers a reality. I think with that, we'll stop, and then we can, you know, go when the Q&As, we can go further.
Yeah, thank you very much, Antonia, and also to our other panelists for your excellent remarks. I'm struck by all of you talking about the infrastructure that is in place. We have the declaration. We have an increasing number of signatories and participants to the declaration. There's some education going on about that. There's the moral imperative of various bar rules, such as in Mexico, that encourages pro bono work, but it's not happening. And what do you all see from your perspectives as really the way to build, what incentives do we really need to build into the system if you were a firm, either a corporation or a law firm in Mexico or elsewhere in Latin America, what kind of incentives do you think would be welcome or needed to get firms to step up and try to implement these obligations?
Well, what we've heard from the law firms is, this is very typical, but I mentioned the A-list for a reason, because it does have an incentivizing effect. One of the curious things throughout Latin America is that nobody quite knows whether they should advertise that they're doing pro bono. I don't mean advertise in order to attract clients. I mean advertise in order to promote the fact that this is something that they're proud of and they want people to know. The whole relationship of the bar to advertising in general in these countries is very, very complex and in many places quite illegal. If you talk to the private sector, they will say, well, we want accountability. Somebody's got to audit this process. We need a reporting system. We need a way to sort of check up on our neighbors. There's somewhat of a lack of congeniality or sort of cooperation among the private bar. One of the things that we're seeing and one of the pushes that we've been able to do as the private bar going in is to say to the law firms in general in Mexico, in some ways it's more has more challenges than others, and we've only touched Mexico City. Remember, we haven't even been to Monterrey or Guadalajara yet. The law firms, in order to do this effectively, law firms have to collaborate. Just like Appleseed has on its board, or the Van Center has on its board, members of a large number of members of the legal community who have come together to make this happen. That's true of the Van Center. That's true of all the public interest organizations who provide cases for the law firms throughout the United States. Well, getting, in particular in Mexico, and I'm interested to hear what Alexis has to say about this later, to get the Mexicans to cooperate in that way has proven to be quite a challenge. Because again, what incentives are there? If sort of everybody's in the same boat, and it becomes a social and political and business imperative to participate in this, then you will participate. Going back to your comment that this is not about charity or alimosinary impulses or philanthropic impulses, it's about building the pro bono into the culture of the firms. And my view is that if we don't push the firms in that direction, now the places where we've had great success, Chile being among them, is the law firms came together now 5, 6, 7 years ago. They have a Fundación Pro Bono. It's funded by the law firms. It's blessed by the Supreme Court. The law schools are involved. The whole civil society has come together, and it's really enormously successful. And the Chilean law firms are enormously proud of what they're doing. We're encouraging that model throughout the land, and I think it's something that Appleseed can be incredibly important player.
You know, I'd like to answer the same question from the perspective of legal education because I had the opportunity to be the president of the Association of American Law Schools and try to attack the law school cultural phenomenon from that perspective. And what we tried to do, we created something called the Equal Justice Project, and we went around the country and gave law schools opportunities to describe projects that were in place and to encourage new projects to add to the curriculum access to justice, to add to the service component of the law school, access to justice, and add, of course, to the scholarship of faculty, access to justice. And we tried to give people a platform to talk about and brag about what it was they were doing. So in the same way that American Lawyer provides that for law firms, we tried to do that for law schools. The year before I was president, Deborah Rohde was the president of the ALS, and she had a project on pro bono. What pro bono projects would be implemented in law schools? Same thing. So we all recognize that it's very important to attack this at the level of recognition as a way of recognition, bringing new ideas, networking, and ultimately changing the culture in that way. You know, the mystery, though, for in America, legal education is at the graduate level. And we have, I think, always embraced the idea that we're forming the identity of future lawyers through what we do in the law school. We're specifically doing more than teaching legal doctrine. In most countries where law is taught as an undergraduate discipline, first of all, in the 4 years, less law is taught than is taught in an American law school, and fewer subject matters are embraced as a part of professional identity creation. So a lot of the teaching is about legal doctrine, and it's done through lectures. In Chile, which is an interesting exception, even though that is the major legal educational system, clinical education started in Chile, funded by the Ford Foundation, at about the same time as it started in the United States. The movements grew up independently and in slightly different ways, but in the end, in Chile, their law students do represent poor people in clinical programs, and I think that may partially explain why you've been more successful in Chile than in elsewhere. Now, that's spreading through the rest of Latin America. I also don't want to be heard as saying that clinical education is the be-all and end-all of teaching students the importance of being responsible for access to justice. The stories that are embedded in our culture from To Kill a Mockingbird to Amistad to Gideon versus Wainwright and the role of Arnold and Porter in that case. The stories in our culture are of heroic lawyers doing good and making a social change. And those stories need to be told in various ways throughout the legal education, throughout legal education, throughout the 3 years. And cases that are studied in school need to include cases where lawyers made a difference. And that needs to be part of the conversation. Programs like student voluntary organizations that provide various forms of help to lawyers who are doing pro bono work are also quite useful. And so I think has to be more pervasive. So I don't want to claim that if everyone in the world had clinical education, there would be justice in the world. But I do have a clinocentric view of
No, if I can just add something, as a foreigner, I think that one thing that strikes a foreigner here is how good Americans are for marketing. And marketing, yes. And I was actually reading a book on the production of tea. And one of the things that the book said, it was that tea was nothing to do with America until an American got to the tea industry and market the product. And then all of a sudden, everybody was like, oh, the tea is here. And before that, the tea was there, but it's marketing. And I think that that has to do a lot with the pro bono culture as well. You've done a wonderful job, as you were mentioning, on making it, as I again said, glamorous. It's good business to do pro bono. And in Latin America, it's not good business. There is nothing good, and it's not that lawyers were not doing it. It's just that there is not also an idea that that is what they were doing, basically. So many of what I see, it's also sort of repackaging. Of course, there is a need of doing it in many places where there is no culture of doing it, but also repackaging is very important. I think that that tweaking a little bit the product could help, I think.
I would be interested in the views of the other panelists and anyone else in the room on the prospects for systemic change, either through impact litigation or other legal community efforts in Mexico. I wish there were more Mexican lawyers in the room, and perhaps it's an indication that they are too busy with pro bono work or perhaps paying work to be here today. Appleseed, as you know, stresses systemic change. It tries to encourage pro bono work, not on the individual case of a client who has a car repossession or a family law problem or whatever, but on changes that will affect the way the legal system or the social system operates on the lives of many individuals. That's the hallmark of Appleseed. Systemic change has not always been a welcome phrase in Mexico. One of my close friends and mentors in Mexico was an early client whom I represented during the 1970s, a very successful businessman who later became a prominent political leader. And he helped me understand Mexico at one point by saying, look, Bob, much of our understanding of social life comes from our tradition, which started with the Aztecs and then added the conquistadores, and neither of them was a society or a culture known for welcoming individual enterprise or innovation, either in economic, social, or political matters. And so the normal instinct of a Mexican is to ask permission not to go do things when he or she sees a problem, but to find out whether someone else is going to take care of it or whether there is an opportunity safely to go about a new enterprise, whether it's a business enterprise or a social change. It doesn't matter. We ask permission. Those were the comments of my Mexican friends. I think we've seen in the last 20 years since the 1980s a wonderful economic and political opening in Mexico, and the beginning of the Appleseed effort in Mexico, in fact, coincided with the change of political power from the PRI, which had controlled Mexican elections for over 70 years. As that new opening took place under Vicente Fox, coincidentally and fortunately, it was the same time that Appleseed was beginning its effort. So now we see both the Appleseed lawyers and others in Mexico, stimulated by the Vance Center, looking for opportunities to achieve systemic change. The question I have is the jury still out? How far can we expect this ancient tradition of asking permission to change? Will we see cases like Gideon v. Wainwright? Will we see organizations like Appleseed prosper and bring about meaningful social change? If so, what is the time span we're talking about? I would be very interested in
I can't comment. I don't feel like I really know enough about Mexico. I mean, we have Alexis Rovnar here. I really think that's a question that needs to be made to the Mexican bar, because my sense, I mean, you have countries like Colombia with this very powerful constitutional court where impact litigation really is starting to have a very meaningful effect on civil liberties, access to justice, very basic human rights issues. To date, we haven't seen that in Mexico, but I really think I would defer to members of the Mexican bar on that question.
We are seeing this judicial reform in Mexico, which perhaps will
critically needed
insert a lot of new flexibility.
According to my former colleague Jan Perlin, who I consulted on this, in many instances, people don't trust the courts as the instrument to bring about social change.
Yeah.
And they use other mechanisms, appeal to politics and the press, as ways to achieve justice. I think the question you ask is such a fundamental definitional question about what we mean by the rule of law. And when we try to impose an American vision of that, which assumes an independent judiciary with the power to issue decrees that will be followed by the executive branch, that's not a universal in the world. And so what I'm seeing in China is that lawyers find other ways to use law or rules to force the powerful to yield to the weak, and that's a work in progress that are built around the limitations and the spaces that are available in a particular legal system. Our Supreme Court and our judiciary supervises the extent to which the federal government and the state government, local governments, obey statutory and constitutional law. And, you know, for better or worse, that's a role they've taken on. That's not available in many other countries. The other problem that Jan mentioned, which I think was the same as Antonio mentioned, is that it's very, very expensive. There's a very specialized bar in Mexico high-priced lawyers who know how to use the amparo process in order to bring what we consider impact cases. So I don't think that when you ask the question of can lawyers be the instrument to empower the weak, to get the strong to obey an understandable set of rules, that we I don't think we should limit ourselves to thinking about it in terms of impact litigation.
No, in fact, I think one of the activities of Mexico Appleseed has been to encourage other NGOs, help build NGOs to work outside the judicial system to achieve systemic change.
I understand also that there's a very successful and very strong environmental bar in Mexico, and a number of them are graduates of our school. Mm-hmm. But that at least insofar as lawyers are successful, that's one of the areas in which they have been.
No, I was going to add also that in my opinion, also Mexico has a strong civil society. And in terms of women's rights, for example, what we've seen is a lot of advocacy and a lot of litigation. And recently, the Supreme Court had a decision on abortion that it's very important for the rest of Latin America as well. And so I think that we have to grant there is some space there that has been built lately in Mexico. And if I can add something, I think that impact litigation has more service providers than the domestic violence problem, the mother who lost her child in a killing in the neighborhood, and nobody really wants to take that case. I think that impact litigation is really important, and I myself am involved in a case that it's very important. Actually, the Center was the first in giving an amicus to the case on Karen Atala, It's the case of a judge in Chile who lost the custody of her three children for living with her lesbian partner. And we have that case at the Inter-American Commission. But there are three organizations working in that case. And I'm sure if any of us drop that case, there will be five more wanting to take it. But not the mother who lost her child in a gang killing, or all the girls that are raped every day in the streets. So that is the difference, I think, between so far, and that maybe was what I'm referring to, between the pro bono and the free legal assistance. You know, pro bono, it has more marketing so far than free legal assistance. So.
Well, and I'd also say, Bob, that one of the things that we're focused on, again, because of this, you know, key relationship we have with the private bar, is for the private bar, and Mexico is no different, for the bar in the United States is its own member of civil society in a very important fundamental way. And, you know, as a proud member of the New York City Bar, which, you know, founded by Samuel Tilden in the face of the Tweed machine in New York, you know, there is a self-conscious civil society role that lawyers take on in the United States, independent of the government and of their clients. Remember, you know, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense went after Sherman and Sterling and other prominent law firms 2 years ago, telling my Wall Street clients to fire us because we were taking on the cases of Guantanamo. And you know, we all said, excuse me, we're lawyers. That's what we do. And thank goodness our clients said, excuse me, who's the government to tell us which lawyers we should hire? I mean, it was an example of sort of collectively civil society saying the government has no role in these discussions. But the bar in the United States is a very self-conscious player in civil society. And one of the things that we're trying to foster is to say, guys, you as lawyers, as prominent lawyers, as senior members of your profession in your countries, with enormous political and economic power, you need to become self-conscious, independent civil society actors. Because, you know, whether impact litigation is a good or bad thing in any given country, the need for lawyers as lawyers, and you know, Professor, obviously, you know, Milstein, feel this. You know, we as lawyers have an obligation to play that role. And if we can instill that in the profession throughout the region to stand up to the powers that be, even if we're part of the powers that be, that's the twist that we haven't seen heretofore in the region. And that, you know, would have a big impact way beyond the question of whether impact litigation works, because it will allow people to speak truth to power, which the members of the private bar in the United States have never had any trouble in doing. And so they're, in the meantime, you're bringing a judicial system along with you that is incredibly creaky, that in many cases is terribly corrupt, and it lacks transparency.
I just we have a very limited amount of time left. I'm just going to ask one very brief question. When Bob and I have spent time in Mexico City working with our colleagues there, there's been much mention of the Chilean model, and I think you've mentioned that in both of you in your talk about somehow they've reached a critical mass that seems to work and it's getting momentum. What can Mexico learn from Chile that would be helpful in trying to build that new culture of pro bono?
Well, Chile has a dramatic advantage of being really, really small. And the legal community sort of congregates on about four square blocks in, you know, along Apoquindo. I mean, they all moved from downtown all the way out to Las Condes.
It's called San Jaren. That's what it's called. San Jaren. It's Manhattan, but it's in Santiago, so it's Sanhattan.
Sanhattan. So in these beautiful office buildings, and there are only about three law schools, right? Four.
Oh, there are plenty. No,
yeah, but who really sort of, you know, so everybody went to the same schools together. I mean, a little like, you know, in Mexico, you could do this organized around La Libre, right? I mean, the libristas feel very strongly that they're kind of that kind of – cohort group. So it's a relatively small community. They, you know, came out of the dictatorship with a sense that really they were to blame. So, I mean, they had let things happen that shouldn't have happened. And there was some important leadership at senior levels of the bar. And they got themselves organized, and the law schools are involved, and the law firms are involved, and the court system's involved, and it's a place where sort of they were prepared to actually pay up and make it happen. We've been taking the people who run the Fundación Pro Bono. We took them to Peru last year, and they're coming to our big conference in Colombia next month to sort of help get people organized. But in order to do that, the bar has to be prepared to collaborate. And not just collaborate, the law firms collaborate, but they need to collaborate with the Bar Association. That's been, you know, Mexico, that's been a complicated question as to how the Bar Association clinic will work in all of this. And they need to be prepared to pay some money because the service itself isn't free. We think it is an eminently transferable model, and the Chileans are very rightly proud of it.
Well, I'm going to say something really terrible here, and I totally agree with you. I think that Apoquindo is where the who's who is, and one of the things that happened with the Pinochet era is that law firms, that corporate lawyers, were all moved to the Barrio Alto, and the lawyers who help normal, regular people, the family law cases and everything, they were in downtown. And there is a huge disconnection between the people who can afford a lawyer, middle class people, they go to downtown. And the corporate lawyers are in Manhattan, in Sanhattan. Now what happens is, and I think that that's the marketing part, I think that Pro Bono Foundation nailed it correctly. They have all the corporate lawyers in the Pro Bono Foundation. That's where the power is. Whether we like it or not, that is where the power is. And I was actually watching, I have great respect for Pro Bono. I think that they've done an incredible good job. It's really, they've been changing the culture of Pro Bono in Chile. You see the website, there is no indigenous future in any face of anyone working there. They are all blonde. They just got all the names. And of course, as a feminist myself, I couldn't help but notice that the lawyers who work at the Pro Bono Foundation, they're all women. And at the board, there are three women, and they're all men.
But so there are only two women partners at any law firm.
There are no women. Exactly. The women are not partners also.
We're getting a few more.
But having said that, I mean, that's the ugly part, but something good came out of it. And that's what I'm trying to... I'm not sure how to put it without sounding like, oh, she's just trying to boycotting. Quite the contrary. I hope that you don't get me wrong on this. The ugly part is what I'm mentioning, but something really good came out, and I think that sometimes you have to partner with the devil and just do it in a way where you can get out on the right time whenever you can, you know? And, you know, devil is also relative, of course.
You know, I was in Chile for the first time in 1987. During the Pinochet era, and I was there as part of an American Bar Association committee to look at the independence of the judiciary in Chile. And I came back truly inspired by the number of incredibly brave lawyers who were doing pro bono work in Chile. I mean, fighting back in the ways that they could against the regime. There were lawyers employed at the Vicaría, church-funded legal services program that I think the churches have played a very important role, but who filed, I think the figure at that point had been 10,000 habeas corpus cases on behalf of people who, families of people who disappeared, and some of those lawyers themselves disappeared as a result of that. And I wondered whether we were doing as good a job of preparing our lawyers for a civil liberties emergency as some of these lawyers had been in Chile. So I'm not sure. And I think we now know the answer, which is yes, we did. You know, Sherman and Sterling and others stood up. during a civil liberties emergency here, and we're very proud of that. But I don't know. Chile seemed to me to be a great example of a place where there was enough of a history of an independent bar, of democracy, of judges who were able to be independent, and the regime, in order to win cases, had a power to appoint judges to panels, not permanent judges, but ad hoc judges to panels, and only by packing the courts in various cases did they win.
So. Well, I want to thank all of our panelists for their excellent contributions, and we really enjoyed, I think.